Once more unto the breach, dear friends.
Else fill the wall up with our English dead.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, and welcome to another exciting episode of The Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jake and
Jeff McClure.
Together, we are The Personal Wealth Coach, at least for this radio program. But we have some disclosures to give as we move into a self-proclaimed exciting episode. Whether or not it is an exciting episode is truly up to the ear of the listener. Beauty is in the ear of the listener, and we don't fall under that category, nor would we attempt to claim to be beautiful. However, we have disclosures. Those were the first ones. We're not beautiful, and that you get to choose what beauty is. Next disclosure is we are both bald and bearded. Next disclosure is The Personal Wealth Coach is also the name of an SEC-registered investment advisory firm. Not coincidentally, the two people talking on the radio are the principals of that firm. We can't, having said that, offer investment advice on the air because it's supposed to be fiduciary in the best interest of the person getting the advice. There's usually some kind of an agreement involved, and it's supposed to be private. None of that stuff's available for general broadcast purposes, so this is education, or at least re-education. We have a camp for that. If summer camp for re-education, if you would like to join, please sign up through the local Gestapo. economics is one of those that you may feel like you're in a re-education camp. Just a minute. My microphone level's a little bit off. It's up too high. There, that's better. It's a bit better anyway. Okay. The next disclosure is I just told you that the firm is an SEC-registered investment advisory firm, and boy, doesn't it sound amazing to drop names of government organizations. That wasn't meant to be a name drop. It was not meant for you to believe that we have somehow been approved or given golden status by the SEC. They don't do that. They don't know how to do that. They wouldn't know how to do that if they had instructions to do that. They don't approve of things. They are very good at disapproving, and they haven't disapproved of us yet. So that's, I guess, but...
Well, in a sense, they kind of passively disapprove of everything.
Yeah, that makes sense. There's a passive disapproval. They're just waiting for the mistakes.
It's basically, we disapprove until further notice, yes. Until there's, when in doubt, disapprove.
Right.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah, that makes sense to me, too. That's basically our relationship with the SEC. We're registered with them. They don't approve of us. But so far, they haven't told us we're being bad either. So, there.
It's the Lincoln County Wars.
Where Billy the Kid was a deputy right, and not a deputy at the same time.
Right. It's the regulators.
And the moderators.
The moderators. Right. And we're moderators on this radio program, and they're regulators. So, it's the Lincoln County Wars.
Well, hopefully, we're not going to have... like shooting battles, they're going to get upset if you start making references like that.
Well, no, it's lawyers who do it now. It's, attorneys. They fight each other in court rather than shooting each other. So they shoot each other with their computers.
Still don't want them to fight us in court.
We don't.
All right. That makes good sense. I'll let you do the deeming of information. How's that?
Well, on this educational radio program, you know, so I went to my radio voice there.
I couldn't tell the difference because you're still on the radio.
On this educational radio program, we obtain our information. We obtain our information from sources we deem to be reliable, but we make no warranty or guarantee as to the accuracy or completeness of said information. See, that's lawyer talk again.
Very nice. And we do guarantee the inaccuracy and incompleteness of unsaid information.
By the way, can I say something about the SEC? I'll say something about the SEC.
I'm a little scared, but go ahead.
I am really glad we have the SEC. We enjoy, as everybody else does, griping about regulators and so on. But the fact that we have a dependable, relatively stable method of exchanging securities and buying and selling securities, and people don't even think about the fact that when they buy a mutual fund or they buy a stock or something, it's there. They don't ever see it. It's, they see a statement or they see something on their computer And we in the United States have this wonderful blessing of, if you buy, and I'm not recommending buy, if you buy 100 shares in a corporation in the United States, or you buy 100 shares or 1,000 shares or $1,000 worth of a mutual fund, you don't have anything appear in your hand that you can touch. They're intangible. But we just assume in the United States, it's really there.
Yeah.
And every once in a while, somebody will come along and slip between the cracks, like Madoff, and sell you stuff that's not there. And the SEC pretty much inevitably figures that out and takes them apart, and they wind up going to prison, which is a good thing.
Yeah, we complain about the fact that it takes a long time to do it. But in other nations, it's pretty common for it just to happen,
not happen
all the time. And right, nobody gets caught because nobody's looking. Or the ones that are looking are on the payroll. So we're pretty happy with the system that we have. But don't let that confuse you with not going to complain about the system, because we've got lots to complain about. So, we do not pay for this radio program. We buy advertisement on the station for the radio program, as does the studio. So there is no quid pro quo. This is not paid commercial programming. We've been doing this program. Baldy's been doing it since 1996. After 2 years, I joined him in 98, which means that I've been doing this for 24 years and you've been doing this for 26 years. So combined, we've been doing it for 50 years. No, the dates don't line up for that. You can't combine experience when it's the same experience.
Yeah, it's kind of like time travel.
Yeah. So we're doing it right now.
We're moving forward, but you can't go back, because this is one of those interesting things I looked up and studied for a while. The past does not exist. It's gone, except in our memories, except in our books or whatever we have. There is no such thing as going back in time, because there's nothing to go back to.
No, but if you don't recognize that the past did exist, you're going to get hit in the head with a hammer.
Because
you have to remember that it got started in order to get out of the way of it.
Yep, and you have to recognize that people tend to repeat past behaviors and all of that, but you can't go back in time.
Correct. Well, at least we can't. The one of the callers to the radio program several years ago definitely could, according to him. So
really? How did you do that?
He didn't say the secret, but he said that he could do it. So, you know, I asked him to buy some stock for me, but I've not seen the results yet. So maybe he went to a parallel timeline or something.
In a sense, you can, because we've had clients that were on the other side of the dateline.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
So they're in yesterday. So we could call them or message them, and they were still in yesterday. So we could ask them, or tomorrow. No, they're in tomorrow, and we're in yesterday. Since they were in tomorrow, I asked them what the stock market did today, since it's already tomorrow there, and they never would tell me.
Well, I've got actual examples, and we are actually going to get to the market in just a minute. In 2004 and 5, you'll remember this, there were mutual fund trading scandals. Mutual funds trade after hours. And the trading scandal was that some of them were not trading after hours. So there was a time machine involved there that the SEC dismantled, which is what their job is. So that's another thumbs up to them. Thank you for dismantling time machines, SEC, even if the time machine was only a backspace button.
Yeah. Well, if there was a really big sign on the moon,
yeah,
then you could see what was going to happen tomorrow.
Yeah.
But you can't see what's going to happen yesterday.
From Texas, when you look at the moon is using the same time as the middle of England. So the moon is six hours in the past, because they're...
No, it's 6 hours in the future.
Oh, 6 hours in the future. We're 6 hours in the past from the moon.
Right. Yeah.
So
right,
we can look at the future just by looking at the sky. It's pretty
right,
amazing.
And if there's a really big sign up there, we could tell what was going to happen 6 hours.
Yeah, but the Brits won't put it up there. I don't know why.
I don't understand. Anyway, let's talk about the markets.
Yes.
Oh, by the way, if you want to join in our conversation, and today is October 8th, you're certainly welcome to send us an email at jeff@tpwc.com or jake@tpwc.com, or both, preferably. And we'll try to address it on the air. Well, we had the first week of the new month, and the first week of the new quarter happened last week. This week. Still this week, since we're talking about time. And what's happened, and this is very, very common during this part of the economic cycle, and we are in an economic cycle. Bad news is good news, and good news is bad news, which it confuses a lot of people. I was listening to the radio this morning, and people really were confused about that. Basically, anytime there's good news in the economy, people are afraid the Federal Reserve is going to raise rates further, faster, and they're going to cause a big recession in the economy to come crashing down in flames. So anytime that there's good economic news that any other time would cause the market to go up, it causes the market to go down. And if you understand that, you probably can get a Nobel Prize.
Yes.
What happened was the job growth rate became less than it has been in the past, but it's running at approximately twice normal speed. What does that mean? In other words, 263,000 new jobs were created last month, net of layoffs. And that's about twice as many as the economy can normally tolerate. We indeed lost a lot of job openings. They dropped by 1.1 million. But there's still way too many job openings. And as a result, wages are going up, which means the Federal Reserve says inflation's going to go up because wages are going up at 5% a year. And so the stock market went down on Friday. It went up the first part of the week because everybody, well, people were hoping, traders on Wall Street were hoping to see a bad jobs report, and they got a good jobs report, which was bad. And it, like I said, that's pretty. Anyway, the S&P stock index is the one, S&P 500 stock index, which is what we use as the representation of the main stock market, rose. Get this. It rose 1.5% this week. You wouldn't know it from the headlines. You'd think it crashed. It closed at 3639.66. So that little rise left it roughly where it was at the bottom in mid-June. So we're not down, we're not up. We're pretty much where we were in June. It's down 23.64% year to date. 17.12% from 1 year ago. Now, let's back up. If you are an investor and not a speculative trader, and I don't think a lot of speculative traders listen to this show, then look back 3 years and you'll see that the S&P 500 is up about 23%. It's up 63% from where it was in March of 2020, the last time we had a bear market, which if you were thinking about bailing out at that point, and you're thinking about bailing out now, that should give you some lessons right there. And this is a critical thing. We mentioned this in the newsletter, but this is something to get in mind. The bull market top just before the pandemic-induced bear market of 2020 was 3386. Okay, did you get to 3386?
Okay, that's the top pre-pandemic.
The highest part of the bull market just before the pandemic in 2020.
Okay.
We are currently at a bottom, maybe not the bottom, but a bottom in the bear market at 3639. In other words, the bottom so far in this bear market, and it's twice gotten down there and then turns around and comes back, is higher than the top in the last bull market before this one.
It's a really good perspective for anybody that's been in the market a while. If you jumped in the market in the pandemic, probably not a good perspective for you because you feel like you have lost large amounts of money. Time is one of those things that I'm not sure it heals all wounds, because decapitation is, I don't know if that's a wound. It's a fatal wound, I guess. But time as a reference item sure makes the market's downs seem less painful. Still painful, but less painful.
And if you have a longer perspective, it becomes even more dramatic. Anyway, we follow another index, the CRSP, U.S. Mid-Cap Value Index, because we like value and we like mid-cap, and so we like mid-cap value.
Hold on. I have to call this out. You just made a reference that I should respect your age, and I appreciate that. That's very nice. I said, time doesn't heal all wounds. I was all philosophical, and then you added just that little blurb that they're in. And the more time you have, the more dramatic it is. I respect your age. Thank you. Thank you for telling
Thank
me.
You. Thank you very much.
Okay, back to you.
I am well aged, like good wine. Anyway, the CRSP U.S. Mid-Cap Value Index, and this is something that is more or less typical behavior through history. It doesn't always happen in the short term, but the mid-cap value index was up 1.7% close at for the week to close at 2134.66 and down 17.81% this year. Now, with all these numbers flying around, Put this in context. Mid-cap value is down 17.81%. The S&P 500 is down 23.64%. Why is that? That is a historically long-term normal relationship. Value stocks are priced on the underlying value of their assets. Growth stocks are priced on the hoped-for earnings in the future. During down markets, historically, and this is not doesn't happen 100% of the time, but during down markets, historically, and particularly over long periods of time, value-based stocks fall less far because they have less far to fall. And in this particular case, they're doing exceptionally well. And this is the thing I wanted to say about the stock market. Everything seems to be working out there pretty much as what we call portfolio theory says it ought to, despite the fact that the news media is proclaiming it's not. Now, by the way, the bond market down 14.6% this year. So if you say a mixture of stocks and bonds, you ought to do really, really well. No, because it's a myth that stocks go up and when bonds go down and bonds go down when stocks go up. No, it doesn't work that way. But anyway, this is what's going on out there. The yield on the U.S. 10-year Treasury note, we follow that pretty closely. That rose to 3.89%. Now, the 2-year Treasury note climbed to 4.3%. And when the 2-year note is yielding higher than the 10-year note, that is a signal from the Treasury market that it thinks it's kind of like a falling barometer. You're along the coast and the barometer is falling pretty fast. You might want to consider moving inland for a little while. So we have an inverted yield curve, which is a signal that there's a recession coming of some kind. The Treasury curve actually became more pessimistic this week, because the 10-year note, the one I just cited, 3.89, now has a higher yield than the 30-year bond, which means that pretty much the whole Treasury yield curve is backwards, which is an indication that we're probably going to have a recession. So there it is. Now, the Treasury market, if you look out at the 2 and 3 year notes, and it's a free auction bid market, so it's the what you're seeing in these interest rates is the opinion of people who are buying treasuries and selling treasuries about what they think interest rates will be in the future. 2 and 3 years from now, the treasury market is telling us interest rates, short-term interest rates will be around 4.3, a little over 4.3, 4.6%, something like that. Well, since short-term rates right now are still in the 3% range, that means there's probably the Treasury market, and not coincidentally, several members of the Federal Reserve Board are strongly suggesting that short-term rates will rise another 50%. And here is a key point. If short-term rates rise another 50% and mortgage rates are where they are today, mortgage rates generally tend to follow the Fed. We may see 11% mortgages next year. That will be devastating to the price of houses.
Yeah.
We may see the interest rate on automobile loans go from 6% to 9 or 10%. That will be really hard on auto sales.
Real quick time out here, those of you that are suddenly saying, no, this couldn't happen, 11%, that's way above. Interest rates on mortgages being issued right now fall right at the 7% mark when you add in the closing costs and so on. It's almost at 7% without that. If you're actually looking at what you pay over the life of the loan, we're at 7%, when 2 years ago it was 2.5%. So the spread between 2.5% and 7% is less than between 7 and 11. We're more than halfway there. And if we just keep doing what we're doing, this is a very real concept. We could very, very easily crater the housing market here.
That's what people are afraid of, and that's what people are writing about who are scared. People in the real estate business, the people in the housing business, people who do real estate investments and broker them are really getting nervous at this point about what the Federal Reserve is doing. They want to slow the economy down, and if people stop buying houses and they stop building houses, that will slow the economy down. And if it's already showing up in the price of lumber falling and the housing starts falling, so what the Fed is doing is working. It's going to take a while for it to show up in the inflation numbers, mainly because the inflation numbers have a 1-year lag on them.
Yeah.
But that's the market. We got lots more to talk about.
We're seeing the month to month reactions.
By the way, gold keeps falling too.
Yeah, over the last 3 months, the month-to-month inflation numbers in the United States don't look like inflation numbers. They look like no inflation numbers.
They're starting to look a little bit like deflation numbers.
Yeah, and which tells us something, that the Federal Reserve is really well doing its job. It may be that they're trying to reverse some of the inflation that already occurred. And the way you would do that is by cratering house prices and cratering vehicle prices, because there was a lot of inflation in there above any other expectation on inflation in those two areas specifically. If they're trying to reverse it, that's disinflationary. Now you're moving backwards. That's deflation on bringing prices down. So we'll see. Well, I mean, the Federal Reserve, this is a good subject because we've got a question out there from our most loyal questioner.
And I got some comments about that too, about the question.
Yeah.
Go ahead. You tackle it head on.
Right. The question is, he's, as is tradition, Inquisitor John has taken a digital picture of the paper Wall Street Journal and emailed it to us that we may see where he has circled and so on. This is a tradition that I hope never dies. The article in question is "The Silent Price You'll Pay for Our Mounting National Debt." It is an opinion piece. John says, "Forget politics, since both parties are to blame. What significant events will have to happen before the U.S. faces its debt and comes up with a real plan to reduce it?" Man, when we read this prior to the program, the two of us started laughing, because you can't. Well, first, how do you remove politics from it? I mean, even if both parties are to blame, they're still the ones that have to make the decision to make it go away. At some point, it has to appear on the front page of the Wall Street Journal instead of, I'm not sure how far back in the Wall Street Journal this is, but it's definitely not in the first couple of pages. We've got to get to a point where people are aware that for this year's budget, for fiscal year 2023, Yeah, that's correct. We are in 2023. For those of you that did not recognize that, the federal government's fiscal year is already begun in October, and we are now in next year, according to them.
So you can actually see the future.
We're in it. Yes, we're in the future at the moment.
But you can't see the past, right?
Yeah. So the fiscal year's begun, and when we look at the budget for the fiscal year, there's no way of absolutely identifying this, but it's very clear that somewhere between $900 billion and $1 trillion will be spent on the interest of the debt. So I looked at the article you sent, John, and the numbers are close to accurate, close enough for opinion to suddenly be like, whoa, this guy actually did his research. This is unusual for opinion pieces. In the article, it says the cost of borrowing is near untenable levels. If we aren't already in a doom loop, we're getting close. You've got that part circled as well, John. There's old Baldy here, Jeff, who also happens to be my father, for those of you who don't know that. Jake is the son of Jeff.
Shh, don't tell anybody.
Yes. The easiest way to deal with this debt is to tell the Federal Reserve to stop fighting inflation. And then the debt will inflate itself away, because it'll be a small percentage of the GDP. During this year, our borrowing went up a lot less than inflation did, which means for this year, technically, our borrowing is way, way down on a technical sense. And when we're looking at the numbers, we're borrowing is up. It's just not up anywhere near as high as inflation. So this is one of those weird areas where money's imaginary to begin with. I know people find that difficult. It's about our confidence. It's what we all agree on. It's a shared imagination. We say this is worth something because we believe it's worth something, and it's the best way of running a monetary system. Because it's what all values are. What's the value of a chicken versus a cow? Well, you have an opinion and somebody else does. It's really hard to come to a consensus. With money, that consensus is a lot easier to come to, because we measure against the same object. It's not carrying 12 chickens on a trip to go buy a leg of lamb. if you follow the comparison. Bartering, there's too many variables, too many things fluctuate around, but it's still based on belief. You believe that your piece of dirt is a certain value, and another person believes it's not a certain value. Where the consensus lies is what we consider the true value today. That's everything. And money is just a representation of that. So it's almost like a derivative of the things that we're valuing. So when we look at the national debt, if I were looking at the debt in a personal setting, if somebody came into me and they said more than one-sixth of my income is going to debt, and I measured it out and say, okay, what kind of debt is this? This is mortgage, this is car, this is credit cards, it's all these debts combined, and it's one-sixth. The payment on that debt is one-sixth of your income. I would say that's a pretty healthy mix. You're doing fairly well. Now, are you borrowing money to pay it? Oh, well, that's probably not a good thing. And that's the deal, is that we're borrowing money to pay the debt. We don't have a balanced budget. So the question here is that what has to happen before we come up with a real plan to reduce the debt? And the answer is a lot of pain. We have to recognize at some point a pain, or this is all pleasure. Do you want to give up Social Security? No. Do you want to give up Medicare? No. Do we want to give up the national defense? No. Foreign aid? Well, yeah, but that's a tiny drop in the budget. Tiny. When you look at it as a percentage, it's down at the 1% area. So fixing that, it'd be nice to fix if we think that foreign aid's being misspent or whatever. But the reality is that the budget is based on a bunch of stuff that we all want, but our taxes aren't high enough to pay for it. So if at some point the debt interest gets high enough that we can't have Social Security and we can't have Medicare and we can't have good roads and we can't have a military that's the best in the world, then we're going to say, whoa, we got to get out of this. But it's going to be more pain getting out of the debt. It would be nice if we could all look ahead and say, let's pay this down right now and not borrow so much. In 3 months in 2020, we borrowed $3 trillion for pandemic relief. So was that a good use of the money? Yes, absolutely. We could have had a depression, but at the same time, we've got to pay it back. So you're pregnant with thought here. So please give birth.
Well, there's a couple of things, and you mentioned it in one of them in passing. Inflation, 8-9% last 12 months.
Uh-huh.
That means the national debt shrunk by 8-9% of the last 12 months because it's fixed dollars.
Right. But the payment on the debt is going to go up with interest rates.
Right. I don't question about that. Well, not long-term debt. I mean, if you're holding a 30-year U.S. Treasury and for 4%, which is generally what they are, 3-4%, the payments don't go up a bit.
Right.
It's just that what you get back at the tail end is shrinking with inflation. The last 12 months shrunk between 8-9%, what you're going to get back at the tail end. But didn't have to increase its payments.
Yeah, let me throw in the other piece here. If you go to fiscaldata.treasury.gov, and you can be a nerd like me, the September report, end of September, September 30th report from the Treasury on the average debt for all interest-bearing instruments owed by the United States government is 2.07%. It's going to take a while for that to rise with the more recent interest rates because so much of our debt is locked in at longer rates that were much, much lower in the past. So it's going to take us a while to feel the pain.
Now, you're going to throw something. This article does not include that element.
No.
It also doesn't include another huge, monstrous element. The largest holder of U.S. debt in the world is the Federal Reserve.
Yes.
And I know this is going to sound a little strange, but if the Federal Reserve could simply say, nope, you don't have to pay that back.
Yep. They can forgive the debt. And on top of that, when we look at the average interest-bearing debt, it includes interest paid to the Federal Reserve on that debt.
Right.
But the Federal Reserve then turns around and pays the U.S. government the interest back.
So
it's a 0% interest. It's not included in these numbers. So go ahead.
When Mr. Red Yankee, who wrote the article, says the cost of borrowing is near untenable levels, if we aren't already in a doom loop, we're getting close. No, we are not even in the same state.
Yeah.
I mean, our country is a doom loop.
Yeah. Japan has double our debt as a proportion of its income and is not in a doom loop yet. So the
issue here is far more complex than Mr. Yankee suggests. And by the way, when you see an opinion piece like this, particularly an opinion piece in Wall Street Journal or anywhere else, first thing I recommend you do is look up the author and figure out what he does for a living. And in many cases, there's a conflict of interest there. This is a guy who sets up real estate investments and a firm that sets up real estate investments. And he has a worldview and he has a way of looking at things, and it's on the opinion piece page and it's not on the main page. Is there what Jake said? I agree completely. You want to know what we can do about this? Very simple. Raise our taxes.
I don't want to raise taxes. I don't want to lose benefits, but those are the choices going forward.
Right. In the developed world, well, actually anywhere in the world, as far as I know, we have the lowest overall tax rate paid by individuals and corporations anywhere. Well, when you blend them together, there are some places where corporate taxes are effectively zero, but the individual taxes are very high. But when you look at the taxes we pay in the United States on economic activity, we are the lowest in the developed world, and we like it that way. And the countries who don't run big deficits are the ones who have much higher tax rates, and they pay as they go for what you get. If you wanted to see this problem eliminated, it's no problem. You either have to dramatically, and I say dramatically, cut what the government does for anybody, or dramatically increase taxes if you want to see the budget balance, which would put us into, by the way, a severe recession or probably a depression, which would cause tax revenues to fall like a rock. It's not a simple issue. And as far as panicking over it and thinking we're about to go broke, again, remember the largest holder of the federal debt is the Federal Reserve. And the Federal Reserve, literally at any point, they're not likely to do this in the immediate future, but it literally at any point can say, we'll just buy up all the treasuries. We'll just buy up a lot of treasuries. Their job is to keep the dollar stable, try to keep the economy stable, try to maintain full employment, which, by the way, is one of the reasons they're raising interest rates. Full employment is generally considered, according to the speeches by members of the Federal Reserve Board, 4%. We're at 3.5%. 3.5% unemployment is more than full employment. Their job is not to get unemployment rates lower, but to get it to full employment, which is 4%, which means they are going to work to get unemployment back to 4%. That's their job. That's their mandate from Congress. If you think we should have a lower deficit and not run up a big debt, write your congressman and say, increase my taxes.
Yeah. And this
I don't think, anybody's going to do that, though.
Yeah. This is the tough thing. That's what I mean about feeling pain. We have to feel enough pain by losing benefits to feel another pain to raise taxes to pay it. And we got a long ways to go on that.
It's almost time for commercials.
Yeah, we got to play some commercials. Let's get some. If you'd like to join the conversation, the email addresses in here are jake@tpwc.com and jeff@tpwc.com. That's Tango, Papa, Whiskey Charlie, or The Personal Wealth Coach. We'll be back on the other side of these commercials with more of The Personal Wealth Coach. And we're back with more of The Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jake and
Jeff
McClure. And we've got lots more to talk about. Lots more. We've got world stuff. We've got more local stuff. Hopefully our answer was clear enough. When it comes to raising taxes or cutting entitlements, it's hard. I mean, what is it going to take to get us to do that? I don't know. All it takes is a lot of pain. We're going to have to get to a point where we recognize a problem. And I think that's not a majority opinion by any stretch. It's not even a majority of the minority opinion. It's a very small opinion at this point. And we both agree that at some point, borrowing has to be paid back. And if you're borrowing to pay back debt, that's a problem. But there's a level at which it has to be paid back. And that level is a higher level of debt than at a personal debt level.
Could I interject something here?
Sure.
Something that's really important to understand. A large, very large pool of United States Treasury debt is a necessity for a stable economy.
Yes.
In the world.
It is. This is really important. Go ahead.
There is right now serious economists, the people who actually understand this stuff more than other people, nobody understands it perfectly, are commenting that the pool of U.S. treasuries is too small. Do you get that? It's too small.
Why? Well, let's say, what is it used for on the world stage?
It's what backs up banks. It is what backs up the pension funds. It's the bottom line. Matter of fact, if you put money in a stable money market fund today and you get the interest rates, a couple of percent that they're paying, you probably are putting in a U.S. government money market fund.
Yeah. From a foreign debt perspective, when we owe debt to China or to Japan and Japan has more debt of the United States than China does now. China is very quickly winnowing down the debt that we owe it. They don't like being in that position with us anymore for some reason. This was a great fear for a long time. What would happen if China just dumped all its debt? Well, it would crater their own economy. So they're doing it in a slow fashion. They're moving back from holding our debt.
But if you're having trouble finding somebody else's debt to own.
Right. And that's the deal, is that the United States debt is the highest quality in the world. So it doesn't just back up our pension funds and our 401ks and our banks. It also backs up the Central Bank of Japan and of the United Kingdom and of Ireland. And you just go down the list of countries that own our debt and you go, oh, well, they're using that as a stabilizer for their own economy. If we got rid of it, a lot of other economies on the planet would crater. So we need some level of it. And in effect, all of our money is debt. It's an IOU. That's what money is from the Federal Reserve. If you look at a dollar bill, it says Federal Reserve note. That's an obligation. Well, if you say, all right, I want to get paid back for this note that I hold, I'm going to go take this dollar to the Federal Reserve and I'm going to say, pay me what I'm due on this note, and they will give you a different dollar because that's how they pay the debt on the debt, which is just more of the same.
The fact, and as Jake said, the fact is, our money is federal debt. Mm-hmm. We use federal debt. Matter of fact, if you don't think so, whip out a dollar bill and see what it says at the top.
That's what I just said.
It's a note.
It's a Federal Reserve note. Yeah.
And the point that he's making and I want to make is I don't like the idea that our debt is the size it is. It makes me uncomfortable. But here's where it gets kind of esoteric. The debt of a country who has the dominant world currency has to get absolutely astronomically larger than ours is before it is in any way dangerous.
Yeah.
If we were Colombia and we were dependent upon the dollar, we'd be in a world of hurt. But we're not, and we're not. We happen to be Rome. We have the money that runs the world, including China.
Now, I'm going to give some representations of the size of our economy, and I'm going to do this in a way that's relatively easy to follow. It's not a good picture of the whole thing or any of that, but it's a good example. If you can call an asteroid the size of Delaware, I can do this, what I'm about to do. So it will give you some... linkage.
Oh, okay.
Some anchor point for you to say what is the size. In 2021, before the invasion of Ukraine, before the excruciating sanctions were put on Russia, the GDP of Russia was $1.78 trillion. Sounds pretty big. Would you agree? That's a big number, $1.78 Yes. trillion. Dollars. The GDP of the state of Texas was $1.83 trillion. Texas has a larger economy than Russia. The population of Russia is 146 million people. The population of Texas is 29 million people. 29 million people have a larger GDP than 146 million people, and this is one of the seven largest countries as far as economics on the planet. And you could name a series of other states that all fall in the category of having a larger GDP than Russia. When you start comparing it to Germany and France, you start getting a stretch that California is roughly related to Germany. Germany's been doing well lately. California's been doing well lately. It tells you the scope that we're talking about. When Russia invading Ukraine has such a major impact on the world economy, and their size of the world economy is the same as one of our 50 states, this kind of gives you, when we're talking about debt of the United States, the big numbers are scary sounding. But the reality is that we are a massive, massive force in the economics of the world. Our debt is not good, don't get me wrong. Quite often, debt is measured against the budget. So if we say the budget of the U.S. government is like $6 trillion and we owe like 30, oh, that's not good. That's a lot of years. But if you look at the entirety of the size of our economy, not even just the GDP, what do we own? We're talking about hundreds of trillions of dollars. And when we have a budget of $6 trillion at the federal level, and we have assets worth hundreds of trillions of dollars, it starts to put the perspective of how big the debt is. If a client came to me with a net worth of $20 million and they said, I'm concerned about the debt that I have. I have $1 million in debt and I don't like it. The interest rates are changing. I don't like it. I would not be sounding the massive emergency alarm or waving big flags around. I would say your assets are plenty valuable for this level of debt. And then if they came back and said, well, I'm borrowing a bunch of money and I'm borrowing more than I'm making every year, my answer to that would be, okay, look at your assets and see if there's another way that you can get some revenue for them from them so that you don't have to borrow to keep up with your own expenses. And that is in the context of the U.S. government saying, look at your assets and find more revenue. That's taxes. If I were giving that advice to the U.S. government, I just advise them to raise their taxes. And I don't want to raise my taxes. But that's the reality. We have to make a choice, either raise taxes or cut entitlements or just accept that we're going to have growing debt forever.
One of the things in the steady state arguments, like the one in this article had, that they miss, is taxes under the Tax Relief Act, passed at the direction of and under the Trump administration, I might add, taxes go up very nicely in 2025.
2026, yeah.
After 2026, into 2025. Yeah. In 2026, taxes will go up very, very nicely. And then the government will have more money.
And that's the deal, is that 2026, the revenue to the government is going to go up because the personal income tax rate is going to go up. And personal income taxes are much larger revenue as a revenue stream than corporate taxes. Mm-hmm. So when they go up, and that will be higher than the status quo was before the tax cut, because we're calculating inflation differently now.
Right.
So we're going to have a tax increase above even what it was before we had the tax drop.
Yeah, the Tax Reduction Act raises taxes.
Yeah. It permanently lowered the taxes for corporations, but overall is going to raise revenue to the United States government. And that's because taxes will go up for the rest of us. And that's just, hold that in mind. It's out there, and in projections for the government, you have to include the fact that it's already on the books. They don't have to pass a law. We're going to raise taxes in 2026.
So, if you want to do something about the deficit, if you want to do something about the looming national debt, very simply, when 2026 approaches, Congress will suddenly discover that they passed a law that causes taxes to go up in 2026.
Yeah.
And you write your congressman and say, leave it alone.
It's kind of weird because we're in a weird pattern here. Raising or lowering taxes is not on any party platform right now. The Democrats are not saying, let's raise taxes. The Republicans are not saying, let's raise taxes. The Democrats are not saying, let's lower taxes. The Republicans are not saying, let's lower taxes. So that's where we are. Taxes are off the political board right now. We're talking about other stuff. We're talking about immigration. We're talking about marijuana. We're talking about student loan debt. We're talking about medicine. Nothing about debt or taxes.
Oh, by the way, another small point in the article that John sent, which is a good article.
It is a good article. For an editorial piece, for an opinion piece, I was impressed.
Yeah. He did make a statement that the cost of medical care always goes up faster than inflation. That is absolutely not true. The trailing inflation in medical care is 4.8% in an environment where we are running roughly 8-9% inflation. So
year over year,
I always get a little bit nervous when somebody makes a statement of always,
especially in a time when it isn't true, right at that moment that they say it. Yeah.
And all he had to do is look around and say, well, no, it's not always true because it's not happening right now. And it hasn't happened for the last year or two.
But if we look back over the last 30 years, it's a consistent thing. It's just now suddenly it's not the case anymore.
There's a lot of things that are consistent over 30 years ago. I'm just simply saying when somebody's going to publish something in the Wall Street Journal and make horrible predictions about the future, and they state something in there that is just blatantly untrue. If I were grading that paper, I'd give it an F.
Yeah. So agreed. We're about out of time for the first hour. We got a whole bunch left to talk about. We've got to talk about things with China and the chips and cars and houses. And we got to talk about jobs and German production and, oh boy, lots of stuff. We'll even bring in some personal finance stuff. But in the meantime, if you'd like to talk to us off the air, we actually have people that answer the phone during the weekend. We have voicemail during the week.
No. They don't answer the phone during the weekend. We have voicemail.
I had that reversed.
Weekends.
Didn't I? Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. They wouldn't like that. I made them work on the weekends. No.
You're dyslexic, aren't you?
Something like that. Okay. I'm not going to approach what you just said, though. The local number is
254-947-1111
or 1-800-914-7526. That's 800-914-PLAN. You can go to our webpage, thepersonalwealthcoach.com or tpwc.com, where you can contact us through the contact form or through email, Jeff or Jake at tpwc.com. You can sign up for our newsletter there. You can read the newsletter going back a long time. You can listen to our radio programs going back a long time there. You can find our podcasts wherever you normally find podcasts. Just look us up. In the meantime, thanks for listening, and we'll be back next hour with more of The Personal Wealth Coach.